Next case of the morning is number 023208. Aaron Fillmore against Shamus et al. Mr. Mills?
Thank you, Your Honor. This case raises three interlocking issues in terms of the merit, in terms of excessive use of force. But sort of at the base of all of them, though, is whether or not the district court erred when he concluded that most of our claims, most of the force used here was de minimis and as a matter of law did not violate the Eighth Amendment.
Mr. Mills, can I ask you a question about the record? Is this videotape part of the record that's come to this court?
Yes.
Okay.
It was admitted into evidence. It's our Exhibit 1. And
okay.
Yes, it is. And that videotape makes clear, as the parties in fact stipulated, that during the walk between between his cell and segregation unit, there was no resistance, no excuse for using any force at all. All four inmates, including the plaintiff, were completely compliant with all orders they were given. No attempt to struggle, no resistance, no nothing.
Could I ask you another question about that, though? Because obviously prisons are difficult places to manage, and we've been told many times by the Supreme Court that it's not our job to micromanage them. And one could imagine, at least, that the reason that the prisoners weren't resisting at all and were being compliant was that the guards were taking measures that were, let's say, necessary to send the message that resistance would not be successful. So, I mean, they did have them, you know, where they're holding the handcuffs in various ways and the baton, and I don't know. I mean, I'm trying to figure out when do we enter this picture, because if the guards are already taking precautionary measures, then maybe they're quite compliant.
And maybe that would have been a good argument that the defense could have raised and made to the jury, and we might have lost. But I think it's an argument that they would have had to make, since they have stipulated that the prisoners were not resisting, and they've also stipulated that plaintiff in the case, were he allowed to go forward, would have testified that he was being inflicted pain for no good reason, then that's enough to get us past the Rule 50 standard. The Supreme Court has held, at least since Hudson in 1991, that the intentional infliction of pain, for the purpose of inflicting pain and not for any legitimate security reason, always violates the Eighth Amendment.
So your position is there's no de minimis standard there at all. So if one of the guards had pinched him on the arm hard or something, that's an Eighth Amendment violation? Gratuitously.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have to go anywhere near that far. I think that at some point you run into this court's earlier decisions in Outlaw and DeWitt. DeWitt, clearly the argument there was that he was pushed and he hit against a door frame and had a bruise. What the court said there is, it's de minimis, it was a single action, it was completely isolated. I think this case is completely different. There's nobody saying that, oh gee, he pushed down on the handcuffs once by mistake. This is clearly something that happened from the moment they walked out of the cell all the way to the segregation unit. And it was part of a pattern of inflicting pain that day. This is not a single isolated little incident. This is clearly something that they were doing intentionally for the purpose of inflicting pain. Now, in DeWitt, there was also a security justification for it. He was being pushed away from the cell so that they could search the cell. That was an argument that was presented to the court, and the court accepted it. Outlaw is the same way, where they slammed a truck hole on the man's hand. There they said maybe it was accidental. If it wasn't accidental, there was at least some security justification for it. He admitted to throwing trash on it and having his arm out there where he shouldn't have had it, in violation of prison regulations.
His hand was actually rather severely injured.
Yes, it was. But his hand was also in the truck hole where the court said anyway, prison regulations said it shouldn't have been. So he was clearly doing something wrong, and the issue there was whether or not that use of force in order to enforce a rule was justified. In this case, no one has testified that there was any need to use any force at all to force these guys to do anything, to maintain security, to enforce rules, to do anything. As the record stands now, at the Rule 50 point, the only reason that the defendants used the force they used was to inflict pain. It was not a single isolated push or pinch. it was in fact something that they continued all along a fairly lengthy walk, I think it's 5 or 10 minutes on the tape, between the back of Menard and the front of Menard.
You, I think, indicated in your brief that the videotape really doesn't disclose anything because at times when the assertive violence occurred, it was focused elsewhere. Is that the case?
The worst of the violence clearly occurred off camera. The walk itself and the pushing down of the handcuffs at the very beginning is very clearly on the tape, and you can see it. The pushing into the bars after they arrived at the segregation unit, where he was slammed up against the bars with his face, that is not on the tape. The strip search is intentionally, or at least the only thing you should see on the tape, is the back of a guard's uniform. You can't see the strip search at all, although you can for some of the other prisoners that were searched. And the camera did not follow him up to the segregation unit to his cell at all. It stayed downstairs, despite the fact the camera did follow two of the others all the way to their cell.
What was the purported incident, well, I understand, throwing oil or something on one of the guards, is that right?
By another inmate, right.
By another inmate.
Yes, not my client. One of the other inmates did that, and somebody thought that somehow my client was involved in that.
Was it his cellmate? No, not his cellmate.
It was not his cellmate.
Okay.
It was somebody on a whole different, you can see from the tape, he's all the way down at the other end of the tier.
Were they moving everybody in that tier?
No, just four people, two pairs of cellmates. The person that threw the oil and his cellmate, my client and his cellmate. My client was later charged of having some sort of responsibility, I guess, ordering the throwing of the oil, and was found guilty of that, so he was involved in that sense. He was not the one that threw it, and he was not nearby throwing it.
How long, what was the last time between the incidents that you allege or show the Eighth Amendment violations and the throwing of the oil?
I believe it was roughly half an hour, something that, roughly what happened was they mobilized the task force team, and it's however long it takes them to gather, put on their uniforms, and come to the cell house. I think that's about a half an hour. I can't swear that that's exactly the time.
But it wasn't a day later?
No, it was not a day later, nor was it immediate. I mean, there's no question, and you can see on the tape, the cell house is completely calm. By the time that they get there. There's nobody throwing anything, nobody yelling and screaming. It's a calm cell house when the tactical team arrives. And in fact, the warden and the assistant warden are sitting there standing, just having a conversation with my client before the tactical team comes onto the unit. So obviously there wasn't any immediate danger at that point.
Did your witnesses on your case in chief include any prison guards or any prison personnel?
Yes. It did in the accident, remember there were sort of two trials here. It did in the actual trial, and it would have, the stipulation includes what some of the guards would have testified to, yes. Mainly to put them in the various places they were at. Again, we know exactly which of the defendants were where through the stipulation and through the testimony we took. Well, all of them, of course, denied doing anything wrong, and my client was unable to identify which particular prison guards took which particular blows or did what particular thing. We were able to tell from the videotape many of the people involved. We know, for example, the name of the guard who pushed down on his handcuffs, the name of the other guard who had to physically hold him. We were able to identify three of the four guards who were in the strip search cell at the time that he was put through his humiliating strip search. We don't know which of the two tactical team members accompanied Defendant Cleland up to his cell and imposed the penultimate beating in this case.
And is that something that you inquired of the prison through discovery and they just weren't able to answer or refused to answer?
Well, everybody denied it was them. So nobody refused to answer it. They just all said it wasn't me.
okay.
And my guy is lying on the floor and sees two orange uniforms there, and he's not able to identify who they are except that they're wearing orange stuff. We know everybody who was wearing orange stuff, and that's all the defendants. But they all say, we had nothing to do with this, we didn't do it. As did Cleveland himself. He was not part of the task team, and that's why my client was able to identify him, but didn't know any of the others, and in fact didn't know any others' names at all until we initiated discovery in this case.
Well, I take it the tactical team people wear, you know, like ski masks or something?
Not
or
ski
something.
Masks, they wear riot helmets, the sort of thing you see on
the
police wear.
Okay.
Solid plastic with face shields, bright orange jumpsuits, black gloves. They're pretty well covered. And they also do not wear name tags, unlike every other prison guard in the prison. They do not have name tags on.
What were the observable injuries on your client?
Minor. He had bruising on his wrist and bruising on his back. He did not get medical attention for, I believe it was about 24 hours, but he was not, and there's no permanent injury here. It basically, it's soft tissue injury, as they say in the personal injury field.
Is that consistent with the allegations of the kind of treatment he received?
Yes. I think that you can punch and kick somebody without causing any serious injuries, as long as you don't break the skin. He didn't need stitches. He did have bumps and scratches, and particularly the pain in his arms was magnified because of this injury that he had as a child. He had a sort of delicate wrist because he'd fallen out of a tree as a kid, which is also stipulated too, and that made the injury to his arm or his wrist much more severe than it would have been otherwise. But again, it's a soft tissue sort of thing. It's pain at the time, not so much long-lasting injuries. But this court dealt with that in Calhoun, as did the Supreme Court in Hudson, saying that a serious physical injury is not necessary. What you need is some sort of an injury, and in fact, in Calhoun, you said it can even be a psychological injury. It can even be humiliation is enough to violate the Eighth Amendment. I see my light is on, so I'd like to reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. We'll hear now from Ms. Weiler.
Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Catherine Bosky Weiler. I'm Assistant Illinois Attorney General, and I represent the defendants in this case. As Mr. Mills has discussed, there was allegedly a use of force in this case. However, it is fundamental.
I don't really say allegedly if we have a tape showing the baton both between the man's wrists and being pressed up between his legs. I mean, there it is, right? We can see it.
Well, Your Honor, the district court judge determined that it is unclear from the videotape whether there was any sort of pressure exerted between the legs of Mr. Fillmore. Instead, the district court judge determined that at best it appeared to be some incidental bumping. So it seems that it is unclear from the videotape whether there was excessive force applied.
So what I have Mr. Fillmore's testimony, I suppose this gets us actually to a question of standard of review in the light. We have Mr. Fillmore's testimony that it is being pushed up against his groin and, of course, down on the wrist. And I don't know. I mean, maybe the district court, the magistrate judge, you know, is a tough guy, but upward pressure on the groin is not something that most men would welcome, I don't think.
No, certainly, Your Honor, it would be uncomfortable. However, as you were asking earlier, it is important to consider whether there was any sort of penological justification for the force that was being applied. In this situation, there absolutely was.
But was there testimony to that effect?
Yes, Your Honor, there was. Because the basis of Mr. Fillmore being moved from the general prison to the segregation unit was the result of an incident in which a prison guard was attacked. So the tactical unit was deployed in order to deal with the individuals that needed to be moved from the general prison population to the segregation unit based on that attack. The prison guard was scalded when he was hit with hot oil that was thrown at him.
Well, I mean, I don't disagree that there may have been. My question is, though, and this case went out, I gather, maybe you should explain it for my benefit anyway. This was at the close of the plaintiff's case. There
are a number of defendants, and they were all, their judgment was entered in different ways, so I certainly can. Warden Page, the trial initially was for two of the defendants, and 10 of the other defendants were separated into they were going to have a different trial. At the close of plaintiff's case during the trial, we requested judgment be entered on behalf of Warden Page pursuant to Rule 50, which it was. At the close of the trial, the jury determined that Officer Quinlan did not use excessive force against Mr. Fillmore. Then, after that, the parties agreed to cancel the second trial and presented that stipulation to the district court regarding all of the evidence that would have been presented at trial by the plaintiff.
So you were able to get in evidence as to the need for the force in response to the oil throwing incident.
Warden Page did testify that it is appropriate and common to attempt to maintain a measure of order after an incident.
So my question is how you get that justification. And so in this record, in this case, you were able to present that justification.
Your Honor, I don't know that I would say it was presented as a justification so much as it was presented as a factual explanation.
Well, however, why the force was used.
Yes, yes, that is correct.
And that's part of the evidence in this case?
Yes, it is described in the transcripts from the trial, yes.
Is this baton technique something that's ordinary, does the record show ordinary operating procedures of a tactical unit, or was it being used in an unusual way in this case?
Warden Page testified that it is common to insert the baton between the handcuffs when a prisoner is cuffed behind the back, but certainly did not.
And through the legs?
No. And he did say that that is not common. That is not common procedure. No. Although, again, it is unclear from the videotape that that is exactly what happened, but we do have Mr. Fulmer's testimony that is what happened. It is worthy of note, because there are so many defendants, as Your Honor pointed out, that the court determined for the 10 defendants that he was going to enter judgment pursuant to Rule 52C. The reasoning behind that being the judge's understanding, the district court's understanding, that because the parties had agreed to make a stipulation, they were waiving their right to a jury trial. In fact, in his order, the district court stated that the parties requested the second trial be canceled and that the remaining claims be addressed based on the stipulated facts. This court has stated that when a judgment is requested based on stipulated facts, the proper standard, the proper rule that should be used is Rule 52, and therefore the court's consideration of the facts should be considered for clear error.
Could I mention something that is troublesome to me? It seems to me the logic of what happened here suggests that from now on, the state of Illinois should issue ski masks to all of its prison guards and remove their name labels, at which point they're going to be free to kick, punch, torture, whatever they want, all prisoners, because the prisoners won't be able to identify them and thus won't be able to prevail in a lawsuit.
On the contrary, Your Honor.
That seems quite wrong to me.
Here, Mr. Fulmer was certainly able to identify all of the individuals who were on the tactical unit that day.
But the two people you've argued in your brief, the two sets of legs that he sees kicking him, he doesn't know who they belong to, because one orange leg looks about the same as the next, and therefore, you argue, he loses. And how he's supposed to identify them when they've got riot masks on, they're all dressed the same, they have no name tag, and he's on the floor, is unclear to me. And that's why I say, taking that the next step further, it seems to me, leads us to a very unsatisfactory place.
Yes, Your Honor. Although during the trial there was testimony that stated from different individuals, perhaps there were 10 people in Mr. Fillmore's cell, perhaps there were 4 people. Even in the stipulation, it is unclear that there was, whether there was or was not, another prison guard not dressed as a member of the tactical unit.
That's not answering my question. My question is, procedurally, he asks in discovery, he is not told, everybody points the finger at somebody else. There were people there, and so if no one was there, how were there people there, and how is he supposed to find out who they are? You're not telling, they're not telling, and so you say, oops, you lose, you can't tell us who it was.
Yes, I certainly, your concerns are justified.
And so what's the answer? What's the procedural thing he didn't do that he should have done in order to identify these people who were beating him up?
Because it's unclear that anyone was even there, that is the fundamental problem here. He was able to identify those members of the tactical unit involved in the move who were dressed in the same way who he would not have otherwise been able to identify through discovery. And that he was unable to identify the individuals that were in his cell, that he says were in his cell and attacked him, does not mean that he would be unable automatically to identify them simply because of the way they were dressed. It seems to indicate, given that he was able to identify the individuals on the tactical unit who escorted him from the general population to segregation, that it's less likely that it actually happened. He certainly was able to identify Officer Cleland, and the most important point there is that even though he was able to identify Officer Cleland, the jury and the lower judge all determined that no excessive force was used
right.
in this case.
But I guess I have to say, you can go on, but I find that a non-answer to my concern.
Did the jury make a determination with regard to that issue?
The jury's verdict was a general one. They did not, there were no special interrogatories, but the jury...
No, but they didn't find liability for
correct.
Any of the named defendants.
Correct, but the only defendant who the jury was considering a decision against was Officer Cleland. At that point, Warden Page had been granted judgment, and the other 10 defendants were not involved in that trial.
So the jury's never asked, did the incident happen with the two people? And the magistrate judge doesn't say it didn't happen. He just says, you don't know who they are, and therefore you can't get a judgment against them.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And that's, if the magistrate judge had done what you're suggesting, he'd said, there's a credibility issue here, did this incident ever happen at all, I'm going to resolve it based on the stipulated testimony. I can see that as step one. But if he had decided, yes, the incident happened, but the man's on the floor, all he sees is the legs, I'm still disturbed at the thought that prisons can just beat people up all they want as long as they wrap their guards from head to toe in something that prevents identification and then allows them to deny that they're all there.
Yes, Your Honor, but the prison officials did identify.
No, they never said A and B were in this room.
That's
I'm
correct.
Concerned that there is a loophole here, I guess.
Yes, Your Honor. It is, as for the situations outside that occurred outside of what occurred in Mr. Fillmore's cell, there are only three incidents in particular that Mr. Fillmore is alleging that excessive force was used. One is Lieutenant Wilson saying to Mr. Fillmore, you've had it now. As this court has noted, as Judge Ripple has noted in DeWalt, verbal threats are not instances of excessive force. Second, Mr. Fillmore argues that Officers Henderson and Jack used excessive force, in pushing down on Mr. Fillmore's handcuffs, pushing up between his legs, and also in pushing Mr. Fillmore's face into the bars outside the segregation unit. This also is not excessive. At best, this could be considered de minimis. As Your Honor inquired earlier, as to whether pinching a prisoner could be considered de minimis force, that does appear to be the argument, and Hudson has specifically stated that such instances of de minimis force are necessarily excluded from constitutional recognition as long as the force that is used is not repugnant to the conscience.
How long did it go on?
The walk from the general prison population segregation was, I believe, as Mr. Mills said, approximately 5 to 10 minutes. Not entirely clear on how long it was.
A little bit more than a pinch, wasn't it?
A little more than a pinch, yes.
Yeah. Sounds like it.
But
and that's why the penological justification that Judge Caney was inquiring about, I think, is also important, because if you just gratuitously smash somebody's face into some prison bars, that's quite different from pinching their arm.
Yeah.
And so if there's a penological justification, the person's trying to escape, and you quickly, you know, do the best you can to get them under control, maybe that's one situation that would be justified, just like the front of the door going down on the guy's hand, but gratuitous is different.
Does the tape indicate that anything was said by any of the guards to the prisoners during the walk?
I have not seen the tape, Your Honor. Unfortunately, I'm not clear on it. We did not maintain a copy of it, so I was not able to view the tape. But I believe that there is a tape available.
It is. It is available.
Yes.
This all happened because someone threw something at a guard.
Yes. An individual attacked a prison guard by scalding him with hot oil. And the four individuals that were considered suspects in that attack were the four who were taken from their cells.
So that also raises the question as to whether this may have been some rough justice on the part of the prison guards toward the perpetrators, doesn't it?
Certainly that is a question. However, the force that was applied does not seem that it was to such an extent that it would have been exacting any sort of justice.
It looks like they took every opportunity they had.
Yes, Your Honor. However, because this incident was immediately following an attack, the prison guards certainly had no idea whether there would be any further insubordination, whether these four individuals would be automatic.
Did you smash a guy's head into a prison bar to make that point? I mean, if you're a professional prison guard?
No, Your Honor.
No.
The plaintiff was alleged to be someone who gave the order to have the oil thrown?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor.
And physically located at some distance, I think opposing counsel said, from where the oil was actually thrown?
Yes, Your Honor, that is correct. Although, of course, at the time of the transfer from the general population to segregation, that was not known. The prison guards were unaware of the actual situation.
Once we were moving them, did not know who threw the oil and who was involved in what.
Precisely. Because the incident had just occurred. And it is common practice in this situation for the tactical unit to be deployed. As Warden Page testified during the trial, that is precisely the purpose of the tactical unit, to be used in situations such as these in which the situation is somewhat unsettled. It is unclear whether there would be any further incidents, whether things had calmed down.
The tactical unit also should be trained to handle these matters, right?
Yes, that is correct, Your Honor. Yes.
Was there any testimony with regard to the practice of not identifying who the tactical unit members were?
There was testimony from individuals, from prison inmates, one of whom misidentified Officer Cleland. That testimony was only given with regard to Officer Cleland. It was not given...
Well, I meant with the practice of name tags or other identifying information.
No, Your Honor. To my knowledge, there was no testimony regarding that. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions...
Thank you, Ms. Weiler.
Thank you.
Mr. Mills, you have 4 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. First of all, I want to point out that Warden Page didn't just say that it wasn't usual to do what was done in this case in terms of the baton and putting it between a man's legs. He said that it was not a proper use of the baton, that in fact putting it between the arms is a good way to control inmates, but that he was not aware of any policy that allowed what was done in this case at all. I believe Officer Wilson said the same thing. Counsel also indicated that my client was able to identify all of the other people who during the walk, and therefore they must not have been very well disguised. He wasn't able to identify anybody. They identified themselves during the course of discovery. They produced the incident report, which was listed, the members of the tactical unit that day. We sued them. We asked interrogatories, where were you, what did you do? They all answered them, but as I pointed out before, all of them denied being the two that were upstairs at the end of all this. I also want to address Officer Cleland for a minute, the jury verdict here. The jury didn't find that this incident didn't happen. What the jury found is that under the particular definition that the judge gave them, it was not malicious and sadistic. I think that the jury instruction given goes well beyond what the law requires and allows the judge to order. While the Supreme Court has certainly used that language in various decisions, I think that there's a severe question as to whether or not, especially after Hope, there has to be any sort of enjoyment, which is what the court requires them to find, in inflicting this pain.
You would agree that, I mean, there's nothing in Hope, as I read it, that eliminates the subjective element of an Eighth Amendment claim, but you're drawing a distinction between subjective and the sense of you yourself really intended to punish, as it were, and a further requirement of enjoying it while you do the punishment?
Yeah, I think that the distinction the Supreme Court has made all along is that this cannot be accidental, it cannot be in attempts to further security, it has to be for the purpose of inflicting punishment. And I think that's clearly what happened here. The penultimate beating was administered because they thought that he was the one who threw the oil on their fellow guard. And in fact, there was testimony that Officer Cleland came back afterwards and apologized and said, I thought it was you who threw the oil, and then I realized it wasn't. We beat up the wrong guy. Which suggests strongly that there was, in fact, a retaliatory beating going on here. They had the wrong guy. They meant to beat up the one who really
threw the oil. Was there any contrary testimony that Cleland apologized to your client?
Oh, sure. He denied he was there at all. He denied that he's the one who walked him up to the cell, period. He said he never had any contact with Mr. Fillmore that day at all. But I think that the Supreme Court did not eliminate the subjective component, but did say you could infer the subjective component from the fact that the violation was so obvious in that case. And again, in that case, in Hope, there was no serious injury. It was mostly humiliation. I mean, the man had a sore muscle from being cut to the hitching post for 7 hours, and he had a sunburn. Those are no more serious than the injuries that involved in our case, and there was certainly no testimony in Hope and no suggestion in Hope that the guards enjoyed it. In fact, it seemed clear, especially from the dissent in Hope, that all the guards were doing was following the exact administrative procedures that were there. They were clearly intending to inflict punishment on him because there was no security justification for it. But that's all you needed to show in order to show that this was an intentional infliction of punishment, is that there wasn't a legitimate security justification for it. You didn't need to show that there was some sort of subjective enjoyment or that the pain was particularly bad that was being inflicted. And that's what the judge instructed the jury that had to be done in this case by going beyond the mere use of the words malicious and sadistic, quoting the Supreme Court, and going ahead and defining them for the jury in a way that absolutely required either that there was an extreme or delighted in the infliction of pain.
That is basically the definition of sadism, though, and so why should we assume the Supreme Court used that word unknowing? I mean, I wouldn't make that assumption about them.
Again, because I think that hope, those words were not used in Hope, and there was no suggestion in Hope that any such proof had to be had against the guards, and there was no such proof against the guards in Hope. As I said, it was clear the guards in Hope were merely following the established administrative directives here. Unlike in this case, where Warden Page admitted what they did was not in compliance with the usual practices for the use of batons, and certainly being an inmate was not a usually accepted practice.
Let me ask you one last question. How badly was the guard injured by the oil? Do we know?
There's nothing in the record on that.
That's fine.
Our thanks both to Mr. Mills and Ms. Weiler for their presentations today. The case will be taken under advisement.